Dr. Rock's Radio Show. Thursday 9 p.m. to midnight on peoplesinternetradio.com. We go to 11.
Well, a very good evening and a very, very warm welcome one and all to this week's Dr. Rock's Radio Show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Well, this particular week we're coming to you from a birch and oak woodland in out near King's Lynn at the Harlequin Fair, where I'm beavering away in the Pentos TV talk space, and I've got many people due to talk. We've got Pippa King, who's joining me first of all. Pippa, thanks very much for coming along.
Thank you very much for having me on.
And she's going to kick us off tomorrow at midday with a talk about sleepwalking into the surveillance state, which we'll get onto in a minute. I'll be joined a little bit later by Jonathan Adams, and we're going to be talking about his talk, which is called You Are Being Lied To, The Metaphysics of Propaganda. Then we're joined by the mighty Dr. Nick Collerstrom, who'll be talking to us about did we really go to the moon, and maybe a little bit about this strange flat earth rumour that's going around the place. And finally we'll have Greg Hallett joining us to talk about the Hidden King of England. Well, that's the plan anyway. There's several bits of the system, like the Skype, that mysteriously has stopped working, but luckily all the guests are live, so shouldn't make much difference. So we'll get straight into the meat of the matter with Pippa. And what drew your attention to the, well, what made you get active in looking into the surveillance state to start with? Because I guess you weren't always awake, were you?
Back in 2004, my two kids that were then 6 and 7 were nearly fingerprinted for a school biometric fingerprint library system. And I happened to spot the credit card size scanner in the library and asked the headmistress when she was going to ask for my permission to fingerprint my kids. And the headmistress just calmly said, "I don't need your permission to do this." And it just seemed so against the grain. You know, if any parents out there know that you have to give permission for food testing, school trips, a whole host of photographs being taken, but yet it seemed okay for them to take my children's fingerprints and not to tell me about it, or do it without my consent.
Were they planning on fingerprinting the whole school?
Basically, yes. Just to get a library book out. So I... Yeah. So I... had only by coincidence, if you believe such a thing, had seen a photograph of the same fingerprint scanner online on a website called Action on Rights for Children, and it was one of those pure coincidental moments. I'd seen it online, read an article about it, and just thought, you know, this is never going to catch on. It's a ridiculous application of technology just for primary school children to get a library book out. And yet 2 weeks later I'm seeing the same technology in the library system. And my kids went to a primary school that had 160 pupils in it. It wasn't like it was a big library, a big school with a massive library. So I just got incensed and wanted to really sort of at least get parents to be aware this was going on in schools.
How were the other parents reacting?
A good sort of 30 to 40% were very wary of the technology. However, I mean, we've all been taught well through the schooling system, is that you don't raise your head above the parapet. Teachers, you don't sort of dispute. And it's also very emotive when you put your child into the care of these people for 6-7 hours a day. You don't want to sort of get them annoyed or seem like a problem parent. But this was just too much of an issue for me not to deal with this. And so I wrote a letter to... the head of the council. I wrote a letter, was email, to actually then the shadow education secretary, who was David Cameron at the time. I wrote a letter to the education secretary, who was, I think it might have been Alan, forget his name, but anyway, whoever it was in Labour at the time.
Some guy in a suit.
Yeah, he's the MP for Hesel, so. But anyway, and I got little or no response. In fact, from David Cameron, actually, his secretary wrote back and said, "We don't consider this an educational issue. We consider it a Home Office issue." They weren't aware that that this technology was in schools, because schools are increasingly, especially so now, I mean, 10 years ago, back in 2005, they were under local authority, but they sort of act like their own little local authority. So they didn't know, and they're autonomous in how they spend their budget. So the government wasn't aware of how schools were spending their budget, and so basically big tech, education tech, technology companies got into schools, selling them this equipment, and schools could basically buy this equipment, fingerprint kids, and the government had absolutely no records whatsoever of the technology and where it was.
So did you manage to get any of these other 30 or 40% people, parents, active with you, or were you in the end the only one? I mean, I know John Adams spent a long time objecting as well.
Well, that's how I met Jonathan, through the fingerprinting of children in schools. Quite a few parents were vocal, maybe about two or three. A lot of them, like I said, didn't want to sort of raise their head above the parapet. So I got in touch with Action on Rights to Children, which was the website where I initially saw the photograph of the fingerprint reader, and said, you know, this is happening in my school. What on earth can I do to stop this from happening in other schools? Or at least, it wasn't even really an option for me to even get parental consent, because it's an application of technology that is like taking a sledgehammer to crack a peanut. You just don't need a fingerprint to take a library book out of school. It's ridiculous.
They are, of course, only using the library book as an excuse to get the fingerprints, aren't they? Did you manage to avoid getting your offspring fingerprinted?
Well, what happened in the end was they put a pause on the technology in the particular primary school I was in, and they 4 months later sort of scrapped it, because I don't know whether I was becoming too big a pain in the backside for them, because I'd got in touch with, well, through Action on Rights for Children, which is a little known sort of children's charity, a privacy organisation. They put me in touch with other parents around the UK. So we had a network of probably about in between 5 and 10 parents that were really active, and No2ID, Privacy International, and Action on Rights Children were very helpful in giving us access and to MPs in Parliament. So I spent some time in the next few years then going down to Parliament, talking to opposition MPs, which are then the Conservative and Liberal Democrats, because Labour in power. Labour politicians did not want to talk to us at all about this issue. Their response was, it's nothing to do with us, it's completely up to schools what they do. Bye. So, but the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats were concerned enough, and they sort of said during the course from 2005 to 2010, if we get into power at the next election, we'll do something to address this issue, which was great. But of course, in those 5 years, more schools were buying the technology, schools were using it for canteens, registration, library.
And of course, whilst they're in opposition, it's their job to be the opposition. So once they get into government, the chances of them doing anything about it, it's their job to be in favour of it then, isn't it?
Well, that's interesting, because when they actually got into government, there was a bill that went through Parliament called the Protection of Freedoms Bill. Yeah. And in Chapter 2, Clauses 26-28, dealt with parental permission with taking fingerprints of children in schools. And it's the first legislation globally that deals with under 18-year-olds giving up their fingerprints or iris scans. We had from 2000, because this started in 2001 in the UK, we were the first country globally to do this. So we had the biometric industry throw iris scanning, fingerprinting, facial scanning, infrared palm scanning, where it sort of infrared looks at the veins in your hand. And this was tested at a primary school in Scotland in 2007. So the industry had sort of free rein over the UK school kids to test biometric technologies, different types of technologies, and to see whether it was applicable or not. And the rest of the world sort of watched on and saw what was happening. I mean, I have to say, the two countries that are using this technology really at the moment are the UK and the US. So I looked across the US back in 2005 and thought, they've got to be a couple of steps ahead of the game here. So, and they weren't actually. They were slightly behind us. But what they were doing was tagging their school children with radio frequency identification devices, RFID.
Subcutaneous.
No, they were on lanyards around the children's neck. So they were surveilling their children in a different way. There's no evidence to suggest that the UK government are harvesting the biometric information that schools are taking, because the biometric data stands apparently alone on different databases. But wouldn't
I believe you.
We've tried desperately to see if there's a link. Personally, why would the UK government not do that? But we have no hard evidence. The other thing I think that I had a big problem with was that this, when children in school, they're in a compliance situation. So they're told to do something, they'll do it. And this is a high level of personal data to give about yourself for a very mundane, like for food, for knowledge, for access to areas. There's a deep psychological message that's being sent to children. I mean, my children were 6 and 7 at the time. That it's okay to give that information up to an authority in order to get that access to services. That was wrong. I felt that was really wrong. And that sort of drove me. And another point as well was that I think it's to have a healthy society, you need to be able to express your distaste and dissatisfaction at authorities anonymously. That's how the Berlin Wall came down. That's how apartheid happened. If we're going to biometrically identify ourselves, that takes that right of protest away. And I really am still keen. I mean, this is 10 years later. My children are now 16 and 17. For them to live in a society that can happen in, basically. And that was one of the drivers that sort of sent me. So there's a whole host of issues that this technology brings up when you use it with children. And of course, as a parent and other adults that are looking at this, we don't use that technology. So I can't advise my child or my children, well, this is a good application of it. Let's have that decision. We can make that decision in this case. That decision was taken away from me. It was a school taking over that parental role. And again, that was another issue that I had a problem with, because I'm the parent, not the state. I need to be able to dictate what level of information you have about my kids, not you. And so, yes, but now we have the Protection of Freedoms Act got passed in 2012. And in September 2013, the law is now that if a school wants to process or take a child's biometric fingerprint, iris scan, facial scan, that they need to contact both parents, get a parent's permission to do it. If another parent doesn't wish the child's biometrics to be processed, then they can not consent, and that overrides the consent of the parent. If both parents consent and the child doesn't consent, that non-consent overrides the consent of the parent. So I was pleased in the fact that the non-consent always overrides the consent. But in my eyes, personally, I just don't think this technology is appropriate to be used in schools.
And I think that it was pretty much the case that they should have asked your consent in the first place. There was no need for an act anyway. And I wonder how widely that's going to be enforced, because by the sound of it, quite a lot of our children have already been, or our offspring, as we like to call them, because children is one of their words, apparently, as kids. But offspring or property is what they actually are. But it sounds like a lot of them have already been fingerprinted and all of that. It sounds like they've introduced the legislation just bolting the horse after the stable's gone, or whatever the phrase is.
Absolutely. Back in 2007, we as parents sent some Freedom of Information requests out to schools, and we reckoned back then there was about 2.7 million children that had their fingerprints on a database. The school population in Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland and the UK comes to about 9.2 million. So that was a fairly hefty proportion back in 2007. Now we think there's probably about 6.5 million children. So not all schools are using it, but the technology generally happens in secondary school, not so much in primary schools, because rightly so, mums are protective and we have a lot of communication with primary schools. As soon as children go to secondary school, they're walking by themselves, they're catching the school bus. We don't get a chance to speak to each other as a community. The school tends to communicate electronically with the child, and that parent gets pushed out of the loop. And the biometric industry, I think, sort of recognised that focusing the biometrics in primary schools wasn't an option. So they sort of then focused it in secondary schools. But they use ridiculous sort of sales points, like, oh, it'll improve a child's reading habits, or it improves a child's eating habits. In the States, there was a scheme that was announced in San Diego where they were going to, in primary school, have iPads issued, which they've done, to the school children there. And every 60 seconds, the camera that was pointing in the iPad at the child's face was going to scan the face of the child to check it was that child that was doing, that was operating the iPad. And this isn't about forgetting, and they said, oh, it's about forgetting passwords. Well, how many parents out there have ever had another conversation with another parent saying, oh my goodness, my child's forgotten his password again? It's not an issue. The children don't get this password failure, you know, remembering thing.
Not like we do.
But what it is it's not about recognition, it's about verification of data.
Yeah.
They want to know, the system wants to know, the establishment wants to know that it is absolutely as 100% accurate as possible, that the data that is being amassed against a person's biometric information is correct. And either by facially scanning them or taking a fingerprint or taking an infrared palm vein scan, they will know that that is definitely the verification of the person, an identification of the person that's there, that's doing it. So it's not about security. It's not about taking money into school. It's not about forgetting passwords. It's about big data.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? Because we're not actually obliged to carry ID in these islands. And basically, the best form of ID these people can have is the individual standing in front of them going, hey, I'm the flesh and blood, living, breathing, actual thing. I am the ID. I'm the best ID you can get. And in a way, they're kind of verifying that. But do you think there's any solution to what's going on here? Because once the data's in the digital incubus, it's very difficult to get it out again. And I'm struck by the thought that really school's the last place you want your offspring to be.
I have to say that I started this campaign that sort of culminated in the Protection Freedoms Act in 2012. And I also have to say it wasn't just me. You know, I had a huge amount of help from privacy organisations, sympathetic MPs, other parents. So we did it as a collective. But when the bill got passed into an Act of Parliament, everybody sort of dropped off and went about their normal daily lives again, which I should have done probably. But I didn't, because I thought this legislation is no good unless somebody is keeping an eye on it to see if it's an act.
I would say that was precisely the function of the legislation, was to make people think, oh, everything's all right now. Because, like you say, there has to be, I mean, the legislation, it's not law. And somebody, like you say, has to be enforcing it. And if its general effect was to make people think, oh, that's all right then, and go back to their cornflakes or whatever, then job done, really.
Exactly. And it was only 3 weeks ago, I have a Twitter account, which is Biometrics in Schools, and somebody had copied me into a conversation with a parent in London, and she had not consented for her child to be fingerprinted. The child had also not consented, and they'd both expressed this in writing and verbally to the school. And the child was told to have its fingerprint taken, refused, and got put into isolation for a day, which is completely against the law. Yeah. But there's no recompense for the school at all. There's no the parent said that, because I sort of tweeted the parent and said, are you going to ask for an apology at least? And like other parents, and I don't blame other parents, because it's a, like I said, it's an emotional situation when you give your child into the school's care. She just said, oh, I don't want to rock the boat. And I just found that really sad. You know, we've got rights, and the child expressed its rights. That's the important thing. The child expressed its rights in this case, and that wasn't appreciated, and there's still a lack of knowledge of how the legislation should be adhered to. And so I'm still on it, and
so that's very much an active iron in the fire, and a pretty challenging one, and I think that one should certainly, you know, parents should at least be aware of what's going on. Did you want to say something, Nick? Yes, Nick Collistrom's got a comment here.
Hey Pippa, on our way to this camp, we were just getting some money out of a cash machine, and we saw it got an eye there looking at us. Well, I've never seen that before in a cash machine. I mean, what is going on?
As far as that sort of surveillance goes, I'm with you on that one. I have not seen a camera at eye level in a cash machine before. But Sir Bernard Hogan High, who's the Chief Commissioner with the Metropolitan Police, did an interview with LBC Radio on the 9th of March, saying that he wants the CCTV cameras and cameras, private surveillance cameras, to come down to head height, because now they've got the technology established in schools and they've tested it sufficiently, I guess. It's our turn next. Yeah. And this is it. You know, it's essentially our CCTV street furniture is looking the same, but what's running behind in the software is completely different.
It's probably also worth bearing in mind that these folks, the world management team, they do plan a long way ahead, and effectively they're simply addressing the next generation, where of perhaps little importance now. So you've still got that one in the fire. Where did you go next? Because presumably this wasn't the end of your quest.
Well, no, I have a number of email feeds that come into me on biometrics, so I can see what the industry's up to, what's happening in schools, and what's running now behind potentially CCTV in this country, because of the first trial of what the industry calls soft biometrics is being run in Glasgow this mid-August behind their Smart City, Future Cities programme by a company called NICE Systems, Nice Systems. Okay, now, well, Nice Systems was started in the 1980s by seven ex-Israeli defence military personnel. And they essentially worked in voice biometrics and voice recognition. Glasgow won a £24 million grant from the Department of Business Innovation and Skills, I think last year or the year before, I'm losing track of time, but and they contracted Nice Systems to come and do the whole smart city agenda. So they're running a trial of this, what they call suspect search. So if you wanted to search on the internet for Nice Systems suspect search, go and take a look at their YouTube channel video on that promotion, because it is, I don't know if anybody's ever seen Persons of Interests. The opening credits for that television programme, which has been going, I think, for about 3 years, is virtually identical to Nice Systems' promotion of their product, which is going to be running behind Glasgow high-definition CCTV, which actually is IPTV, which is Internet Protocol TV. It's not now connected by closed-circuit cables anymore. This is Internet CCTV. So that's going ahead this mid-August. Edinburgh Council have also expressed an interest to run a similar system. We've got a company called NEC Corporation. Leicestershire Police are running a system called NeoFace on their custody suite photographs. The Metropolitan Police are running a facial recognition system called Morpheo on their facial recognition. So you couldn't honestly make this up. You've got NeoFace and Morpheo and Nice Systems. I don't know, I think the use of the language with the companies that are running these tracking systems or facial recognition systems is interesting, yeah. To say the least.
We were talking a little bit when we were offline, and the conclusion we came to was that the best thing would be for everybody to wear a burqa. How do you think about that as a solution?
A burqa or a balaclava, but there's actually, you can use face paint, because the way these facial recognition systems work is that they're looking at the distance between the corner of your eyes in relationship to your nostrils and the corners of your mouth, and you can Google or search engine a photograph of what a facial recognition system does. But if you use face paint, you can actually confuse the system by painting dark spots on your cheeks. So if you see somebody walking around town that has some very odd face paint on, maybe they know something that you don't. Maybe they know that there's a facial recognition system going on or a soft biometric system. But recently there's a big music festival that's held at the end of June in at Donington called the Download Festival.
Yeah.
And Leicestershire Police, who are running NeoFace on their custody suite photographs, were running a real-time live test of, it's called NeoFace Watch. And that was done, and they had an article in an online publication called The Police Oracle, which is the police's own sort of journal and magazine. You have to log in to read the articles there, and I log in and read the articles because I want to know what's going on. I don't care. And I log in with my real name. I don't have a pseudonym. I don't care. And they were sort of saying that, oh, we're going to use this at the Donington Download. And I tweeted it, but I knew I don't have, you know, I'm not as out there as some journalists, but I had a journalist friend at the Register, and I basically gave him the article, and he did an article on it, and it hit the Independent, ITN, it hit the mainstream, which was really good. Leicestershire Police weren't happy because they actually wanted to run it covertly without telling the 90,000 festival goers they were running it, and weren't happy that the Register had basically outed their use of real-time facial recognition behind CCTV.
Starfall Jones has put into the chat box, when CCTV is at eye level, note how many. Oh, it's just moved up. Hold on a moment. When CCTV is at eye level, note how many are put out of use by clothing items and spray paint. I'll go out of my way to cover them in fresh green foliage whenever it happens. That could be a good game for us, couldn't it?
It could. I think when Sir Bernard Hogan Howe was on LBC Radio, he subtly made the point that we're used to it now. We've been conditioned. We've seen it at 14 foot high, and that's why it was high, because initially we did sort of mark the cameras. But they're bringing them down now, and I suspect because you don't always have what looks like a camera. You have these domes that the camera's hidden behind, and it's not always very obvious where these domes are or that it's actually a camera. I live in Hull, and I noticed on the outside of buses in Hull, there are domed cameras. I've got a friend that lives in Birmingham, Steve Jolly, he's noticed the same thing. The cameras are coming down in Birmingham at the train station to about 8 foot to head height. So watch it. Watch what's happening with the CCTV, because it'll give you an idea of possibly what the long-term planning is behind bringing the cameras down.
Well, the thing is, in the long run, I mean, if they're doing it to get our offspring, so they need to get a book out of the library, or go to the loo, or go out onto the playing fields or whatever it is, it's clear that you're moving towards a system where you no longer need tickets, where tolls can be pulled just like that. There's no longer any need for toll barriers and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it sounds pretty much unutterably grim, really, especially when all of this stuff's getting fed into God knows what computer systems and for whatever end. Firstly, do you think there's any solutions to this for us? And also, what kind of response are you getting from other people and these politicians and stuff? Are you managing to whip up a frenzy of support?
That's an excellent question, because when I started with my children's biometrics back in 2005, I was just a mum. I had no knowledge of the political system, no knowledge of the legislation and the laws we've got. There are two really fantastic tools that I've used. One is the Data Protection Act, which actually isn't very strong in the UK, but it's still an Act of Parliament, and you have to use what tools are there. The second one I've used to absolutely great effect is the Freedom of Information Act. You can ask a local authority or a government department any questions you want. Simply type them an email, ask the questions, and at the bottom just say, please consider this a request under the Freedom of Information Act 2000. They have to get back to you within 20 working days. And that's all I've done. I mean, it was a bit... when I first used and sent my first Freedom of Information request, I was a bit scared to press send. You know, I've never used an Act of Parliament. I mean, you know, I'm actually a music teacher by trade. This is very alien to me. But it works to great effect, and they have to abide by that legislation. There's two other great websites that I found were very good. One is theyworkforyou.com. That is a great website. There's a search box there. So I would type in biometric, and I could see all the MPs that were asking questions on biometrics. Found an MP, or you find an MP that's got the same concerns or interests of you, and contact them. The second website, which is an amazing website that I use, is a website called whatdotheyknow.com. Both of those websites are run by a group called Open Society, I think. And whatdotheyknow.com has hundreds of thousands of Freedom of Information requests on. So if you wanted to send a Freedom of Information request, I would recommend you go to What Do They Know, type in the topic that you're concerned about, and see who else has been asking Freedom of Information requests. Because it may be, A, that you don't want to send it, or B, there's a whole lot of additional information on there that you can use. So I've basically used the Freedom of Information Act 2000 to ask various different police forces on their use of facial biometrics behind CCTV or on the custody suite databases. And once you've got that information, you have a certain amount of responsibility, I suppose, to collate it and then distribute it out there, which is why I'm really appreciative that you're doing this, Doc. But so I have done this since March this year, and I collated a report together, gave it to the Biometrics Commissioner, the Surveillance Camera Commissioner, a member of the House of Lords, member of the House of Commons, Biometrics Institute, NetPol, Big Brother Watch, the Open Digital Rights Group, and over half of those people within less than a week have got back to me expressing an appreciation that I've done the work that I've done. And anybody can do this, you know.
And the thing is, the commissioners of these things and the other various responsible individuals don't necessarily know what's going on, do they? Because it's a bit of a yes minister position, I would assume, where they're given a beneficial gloss of the whole thing and perhaps don't have the time or the energy to look into it any further. Are you in sort of sustained correspondence with any of these people?
At present, yes. So hopefully, at the moment, we're waiting on... the Home Office is meant to issue a report in spring on the police's use of facial biometrics. That got delayed. A particular Lord that's in the House of Lords for the Liberal Democrats, Lord Scriven, has been asking some questions, pressurising the Home Office to dish this report up. But again, this is exactly like it was with the biometrics in schools. They're using that technology and they're not apologetic, and people are asking questions, and it's like the horse has left the stable and we're trying to shut the door after it's bolted. Same MO that's been happening in schools, but now it's our turn.
So where are you going to go next? What are your plans to carry it forward? I've put the link, by the way, into the chat box. We'll say it out loud as well for the people who are listening to the pod. Pippa's got a blog called Pippa King, all one word, .blogspot.co.uk, where she's got tens of thousands of words about this sort of stuff if you want more detail. And I'm hoping she'll come back on the show in later weeks to go into some of this in a bit more detail. But where are you going to go next? You're obviously being kept well busy.
It started Biometrics in Schools. The website you've just read out is specifically about biometrics in schools, and I think probably it's the only website on the internet that's specific to that. And I do get contacts from parents sort of worldwide on the subject. I didn't want to muddy that blog by talking about the police's use and the adult use of biometrics. So I have another website that's called stateofsurveillance.blogspot.co.uk, and I've written about four or five articles there that detail quite thoroughly the state of surveillance that we're in at the moment. And Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire has thankfully sort of reproduced a couple of my articles that I've written on that website on his website as well, because he's got a bigger audience, a far bigger audience than me, so I appreciate that, and I appreciate you having me on as well.
Well, it's a real pleasure, I'm sure. As anticipated, I noticed Nodon's put into the chat box, Jade Helm is all about tracking you. Don't you think the UK doesn't have the same tech? Do you know anything about Jade?
Only what I've seen on the internet. And it wouldn't surprise me if even that's part of the operation. If they were running something that was that secretive, it wouldn't come out. And I just wonder, like the Snowden and the Assange revelations, essentially society's just carried on the same. And even after the Jade Helm sort of revelations that we've had, who's caring about it? You know, I care about it.
I think one of the things that's important there is by actually mentioning Jade and Jade Helm, putting the two together, what you're doing is generating an awful lot of YouTube traffic and Facebook traffic and all that sort of stuff, all of which can be kind of, I don't know, fed into it if it exists, and that basically would be a really great test of, say, what would happen. You do it in America, you find out what would happen, at least what people would think if you were going to deploy it in a friendly nation or whatever.
I have to say, as well as Glasgow running this biometric tracking system that they're going to start in mid-August, they also have intelligent CCIPTV, where they can predict crime hotspots and look at footfall in certain areas and look at people gathering. And it's all, to me, that's a scary, going down the sort of scary road of looking at people who you're associating with, and then almost sort of going back to a Minority Report scenario where they're predicting crime in you. I think only this week, was it two parents of Muslim children got tagged, GPS tagged, just because they the system thought they might take their kids somewhere. They haven't committed a crime. Is this where we're going?
And this go for it, John.
Sorry, no, I was just going to say, I think that's something that's been massively missed over all this coverage of these alleged kind of itinerant Muslim teenagers that have up sticks and gone to fight for whomever in Syria and other places, is that nobody seems to be batting an eyelid that we are arresting, or I say we, the UK are arresting people for an intent that they've not yet expressed. It is exactly that. It's pre-crime. Can you be arrested for something you've not yet done? Really?
You can if you consent to it. Exactly. This is why we emphasise all the time the fact that in order for any of this to be done, you've got to somehow be ceding the jurisdiction. You might be ceding it by not knowing about what's going on in the case of the school fingerprinting, but in the case of the children and the pre-crime and stuff like that, at some point you're contracting, and the ability not to cede that jurisdiction might now start making all the difference.
I think that's critically important, and actually I think that ties in so tightly with what Pippa's been doing incredibly well for quite a long time now, which is the grooming by the state of the young to respect authority and its demands at all costs. It's about obey and conform, all, you know, from the very get-go. So yes, it is about consent, but what they are attempting to do is to groom a whole generation of citizens who will consent, who will do exactly as they're told.
I think that's probably exactly correct, and that's where we'll be going next, John. Well, thanks very much, Pippa, for joining us, and it'd be really great to have you on again at some point and listen to your talk. Really looking forward to it. And once I've heard it, we'll be able to talk some more. So thank you very, very much for joining us on peoplesinternetradio.com.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So I'm going to play a couple of tunes, and then we'll come back with John Adams, the progenitor of Pentos TV, Talkspace and Pentos TV. But I discovered to my great joy that on Sunday at the Harlequin Gathering at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we're going to be treated to the John Preston Tribute Band, who have been a great favourite of Dr. Rock since I met him in a field, probably at the Green Gathering, I think. So in celebration of that, here's the John Preston Tribute Band and their track, Ruling Class. So, welcome back. That was John Preston's Tribute Band and Ruling Class. And we're now joined by John Adams, who's going to be talking with us about You Are Being Lied To, The Metaphysics of Propaganda. But before we get into that, John, we were just having a bit of a chat about writing letters to people instead of sending them emails. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm a big fan. If nothing else, as you just said yourself, it's opportunity to help tie up the bureaucratic machine. You know, one of the reasons that the machine works as well as it does is because it's compartmentalised. Okay, and people just do their little bit of the puzzle, and if they want to keep their heads down and have an easy life and a decent pension, they don't look over the sides into other people's boxes. They just get on with their own bit, collect their fat pension and the nice pay, and they don't worry about it too much. And there's a part of me kind of, I don't blame them for that if they want a nice, easy, quiet life. But the way in which the bureaucracy functions is to have all these disconnected but without knowing about each other. The way that you can knacker it is by keep feeding bits in that keep it occupied doing stuff that you want it to do instead of stuff that they want it to do. So, yeah, I agree entirely. I think it's a very good idea.
Yeah, because if, say, 1,000 people send emails in and the like, then they have a tendency to all end up in one directory and get dealt with as kind of a single thing. Whereas if you're getting 1,000 things written in blue pen on blue paper and carrying a first-class stamp, I fundamentally think you're dealing with an actually different thing altogether.
Quite so. And I would always say, if you can, you can be bothered, send it recorded delivery, because they can't argue about having had it, or what do they call it, signed for post now. Always say, I look forward to your reply at the end. So they know they've got to do something.
How about yours in anticipation of your compliance?
Yeah, even better. I like that one very much too. Yes.
So what about the metaphysics of propaganda, John? Where are you going to start with that?
Okay. The talk began life really as an expose of three major military conflicts of the 20th century, World War One, World War Two, and Vietnam, and kind of revealing the dirty tricks that government and media particularly get up to make it look as though that they are the aggressed against, when in fact they are the aggressors. And in each case, that's exactly what happened. What I then moved on to was stuff that I was discovering about quantum and quantum law and quantum mechanics and how that works. And I started discovering about essentially manifest reality. So the way, and of course this is what magic is about, is the application of focused intent. But the way in which that our own unfocused intent has been harnessed and marshalled by those of nefarious intent of their own to create their own reality, not of our choosing. And so, if you like, it's more than just making baby kissing politicians electable. It's about hijacking people's manifestation energy and directing it to somebody else's ends.
And basically, even if that wasn't happening, even if it was just a matter of we the people, however many thousands and million of us there are, being unfocused, and the very small number of world management team being extremely focused over thousands of years, that in itself would result in the kind of chaos that we're seeing, just our own unfocused. So in a way, they're kind of doing us a favour, aren't they? Because one way or the other, we are being forced to focus. Personally speaking, as I've said before, I think that if it wasn't for the work of the dark power holders or the black t-shirts or whatever we want to call them, I personally would just be sitting around with my feet up drinking beer, and I certainly wouldn't be sitting here in the middle. I'd be over there dancing, not sitting here doing this. So actually, just by bringing people's attention to it, we're doing something, aren't we? What do you hope to achieve with your talk?
What do I hope to achieve? I suppose, you know, Nietzsche called it the collective unconscious, didn't he? And I beg your pardon, of course, yes, Jung. And we talk really about the 100th monkey syndrome too, you know, and the fact that we can reach a tipping point through enough people switching on, I think is an absolute reality. So, you know, any little bit that can help towards that, then great, you know. Get people thinking beyond what they're spoon-fed, would be my suggestion, I suppose. I mean, it does feel a little bit like you're preaching to the choir at an event like this, because there's so many people here who are just completely switched on, or if not, then they're very open to suggestion. That you know, even 10 years ago, you know, you had open mouth disbelief come to bear on you. But that, I found that very encouraging.
Although to a certain extent, the very fact that there's a load of people here who are in a field and dancing and talking to each other does tend to show that they're different. So, I mean, how big was the lie of the Second World War? I thought Churchill was a hero and Hitler was a bastard.
You're leading me, sir. Let's say that Churchill did the same job in World War II that he did in World War One, which was to make sure that the nasty bit started in earnest. He was First Lord of the Admiralty, World War One, at the time of the sinking of the Lusitania, and had more than a passing hand in that, which, as some may know, had a marked impact on the involvement of the Americans coming into World War One, which hitherto they'd been quite reluctant to do. And he then went on to reprise that role in World War Two, where on day one, when he took power, he ordered the beginning of the bombing of civilian targets in Germany, which was beyond the laws of war at that point. It was what he called total war. So this is the point at which it went from the phony war, where not much was going on. There was a lot of kind of saber-rattling and juxtapositioning going on between, you know, 39 and the summer of 40, where it could have been pulled back from the brink. There's ample evidence. Myself and another of our speakers, Nick Collistrom, I spent quite a bit of time at Kew having a look at the records there, and it's become abundantly clear that the Germans made many, many overtures to try and cease hostilities and make peace, going back right to 1939. Okay, it's documented, it's all there, and the British used as much subterfuge as they could muster to make them think they were serious, but in fact just giving them an edge. And all the documentation is there.
And is it right that the Germans advertised in the New York Times or something about the Lusitania and the fact that somebody had put weapons on it as well as passengers?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Germany had formally declared war and warned anybody who was potentially going to travel on the Lusitania, which is a very fast ship at the time, to Europe via Belfast and Liverpool. And they said that, you know, there is a state of war between us, and the allies of one team and the allies of the other are not getting on. And if you do decide to get on this boat, which we're saying is, okay, they're the allies of one team, and we're not saying we're not going to have a go at it, that's your call. But of course the Lusitania was also running weapons. It was running explosives and munitions and materiel generally for the British war effort, and it was a prime target. Interestingly enough, Ballard, who was the same fellow who discovered the Titanic and had an involvement in some of the recovery of that, found the Lusitania and discovered that the holes that made the impact that sank the Lusitania came from the inside. The explosions were from the inside.
You're surely not trying to suggest that somebody would actually plant the bombs on the inside and deliberately sink it to make somebody else look bad, are you?
Heaven forfend, I couldn't possibly comment, but the records speak for themselves, and it's not as we have been told. In fact, you could be saying you're being lied to.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, I think the First World War and Second World War are misnomers, really. It was all one war. I guess the Gulf of Tonkin, which was a Vietnam War one, that was pretty much the same story, was it?
Well, the Gulf of Tonkin was a very interesting one because, as later transpired, what was alleged, for anybody who doesn't know, was that two North Vietnamese torpedo boats had attacked the USS Maddox.
Like a pair of complete and total nutters.
So it's a bit like a kid with a catapult who's gone after an armoured car down the high street. So this is what they alleged, and on the back of that they called that a military involvement and an act of war, and they escalated the whole thing from that. It came out many, many years later that the entire thing had been fabricated, and they could trace it pretty much back to LBJ, the guy who stepped in miraculously after Kennedy had his brain splattered all over the back of the car in Dallas. But what became more important for that event was that, as a consequence, they enacted the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in the American Senate. And that meant that from that point on, the president had the power to go to war without the authority, the direct and express authority of the Senate. And that was a very, very interesting turn of events, which pretty much continues to have ramifications today.
And was that an executive order, i.e. something that stays standing? Because as far as I can gather, they work. Basically, the president can give an executive order, which then can't be repealed, and it stands after it's made.
That's my understanding of it too, yeah. It basically gave one man, and in my personal view, every president since Kennedy had somebody else's hand up his arse, and they've been a sock puppet for essentially the bankers ever since.
And I guess, really, I mean, during World War One, we had kind of like Morse code. We didn't, World War Two, we didn't really have telephones or anything like that, or television hadn't quite arrived either. We had radio, but it means the means of actually kind of executing the propaganda were extremely limited. Presumably, these techniques have become a lot more polished in the modern world.
Yeah, you're telling me. I mean, you know, anybody who does watch TV, I mean, you can't escape, I think, a single commercial break where there isn't an advert and they're recruiting for one of the armed forces. It goes on all the time. They need cannon fodder in the machine because war is an incredibly profitable business, not just from a financial point of view, but from an energetic point of view, and also from a geopolitical point of view, because every time there's another big war, power becomes concentrated into ever fewer hands. And it's been going on for the best part of 300 years, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and we're taking small bloody steps towards a single unified governing world body.
And as we keep pointing out, what they're actually doing during a war is killing the real creditor.
Exactly so, and then all those dog tags get taken along to the International Bank of Settlement, ka-ching.
They sell the dog tax, do they? So why have you chosen to use the word metaphysics alongside the word propaganda? Where are you going with that?
Well, as I kind of touched on a little bit earlier on, the idea that you can create thought forms through those that you put into people's minds through the use of television, radio, print media, or propaganda. So you can create, and Edward Bernays called it the manufacturing of consent. He was the father of modern PR and indeed propaganda. And it stems from an idea where they quite openly suggested that people weren't clever enough to run their own affairs, and so it was the responsibility of these much cleverer chaps to run things for them, but make the people think that they'd made those choices themselves. And it's an extension of that. That's really what it's about in terms of how you lead people around by the nose. What I'm suggesting, though, is that it's beyond mere propaganda. It's not just about producing a two-dimensional real-world end. It's also about manifesting a reality not of our choosing. By moulding our focus, which, as you say, is for a lot of people pretty shabby. A lot of us don't concentrate that closely on stuff, and I think we're manifesting anyway, but we're not just focusing on what it's, so it's random manifestations. If that's then harnessed by somebody for dark and nefarious purposes to make you think a particular way, I think on a big enough scale that can manifest that reality.
So what do you think is the most practical thing we can do? You know, we're being biometrically scanned and fingerprinted and stuff, which is very difficult to kind of undo in as far as an awful lot of it's happened. But in terms of the information we've been given and how we respond to it, that is more down to us, isn't it? What kind of solutions do you see in terms of how we deal with this situation?
I think doing what we're doing is exactly the way to go. I'm fond of word games, and I know you are too, and I like the term ignorance. I think the best thing we can do, you can't ever engage with this thing and expect to win on their terms, because the game's loaded. I think the very best thing you can do is just step outside it and say, actually, I'm not playing anymore. I'm going to have my life my way, and bugger off.
Well, the thing is that, I mean, all the time I'm coming, like, I came across somebody the other day who said to me that the economy was improving, and we know that it's in a fatal nosedive. We know that the word improving and the word economy just do not go together. And later on that day, I noticed that he gets all of his news from a copy of a thing called The Week, which is basically a single thin glossy magazine which covers all the important news stories in like a paragraph or two, or maybe half a page for an important story. And that's what he's choosing to believe. The thing is that actually, we never had a television, but I have noticed that when people disengage from the telly, when they finally do decide to turn it off and chuck it out or whatever, they do change actually pretty quickly. One of the things I've taken to suggesting to people, because removing people's TV seems to be almost as disturbing for them as it would be for a smack addict to have his regular line removed. So I've been suggesting that they try not watching it for 7 days, then go back and watch it again and see if they feel any different about it. It's not worked with everybody, but one or two of them really have felt going back to the television like they're being slapped in the face with a wet kipper. It's like you can sort of decondition yourself over a fairly short period, and then you're in a position to start thinking for yourself. What do you think is the best thing people can do?
I think disconnecting with the TV is an incredibly good idea. There is an internal conflict a little bit with me here, because I've been a filmmaker for the best part of 25 years, and so I've got a vested interest in the moving image. I loathe television passionately, but I can still recognise that in terms of delivering a moving image and the message that you can put behind it, it's still a very, very powerful tool. The trick is to disconnect it from the control grid. So this is where stuff like what you're doing is incredibly important. I love the fact that mostly YouTube still remains largely free. You can do stuff with that. Vimeo's okay. I don't expect it to last indefinitely. I think that you know, the world management team, as you so very appropriately put it, doesn't like the fact that we talk to each other, doesn't like the fact that we share stuff. And of course, as that growth becomes ever more exponential, and it is, there's no two ways about it, they're seeking ways to muzzle that. I think, you know, we need to be mindful of how we maintain our own connections, our own I'm trying not to say internet, interconnected networks, shall we say. I think we need to keep our own going.
Well, I get some hope from the fact that YouTube and Skype and all of these things actually arose from small numbers of individuals doing really pretty amazing things. And then, I mean, clearly they end up so big that they get sold. We can, I think, only hope and trust that the next generation of our ability to share information with each other is coming along the line. But another thing I think is particularly underweighted, shall I say, is this business of actually meeting in a field and talking to people.
Absolutely, and it's one of my favourite things to do. I've been going to festivals for, blimey, a very long time. This is my tribe. These are my people. This is where I like to be. If only more societies were like this. I really, you know, and I passionately believe that. I think that it's interesting too that we've seen the decline of pub culture in this country. And let's face it, we Brits are drinkers. You know, we like a drink, and yet we've seen the greatest decline in pubs in the last 15 years than ever before. And it's not an accident, you know. Them that are they don't like us getting together and talking to each other, especially not over a pint. And so the fact that these events are still on and still happening, I think, is incredibly important. We need to nurture them and hang on to them.
Well, especially, I think, because it's actually... I mean, I'm told by people who I think know that the internet is actually quite robust and it's very difficult to switch it off, but it's not difficult to prevent people getting to the information that they need. And I really like to encourage people to actually meet up with other people to make we have in Mid Wales and things, we have things like community meals where 60 70 80 people come out and pay £2 or £3 and they get a three-course meal, and the meal's really great. But what's really important about it is it's a whole shed load of people from one town who don't normally come out, they don't normally talk to each other, and actually the kind of bent of many people is now to distrust their neighbour, to distrust the individual they see walking down the street. And I've seen many people now over the last 2 or 3 years where that actual tendency, that pessimism in their outlook, can be changed just by one lunch with a load of other people. So our actual getting out amongst each other, I think, you know, even if you only try to do it once a month or whatever, is really incredibly important.
I agree entirely. And I think the idea of sharing food's really pretty primal, and if you can sit down to any kind of meal with people, I think it creates a bond, a really strong bond. But you're absolutely right, this idea of introspection and isolation is part of the control grid. You know, fear your neighbour, fear the immigrant, fear the asylum seeker, fear the Taliban, you know, whoever the hell it is. And then it comes down to individuals. You look down any street in any urban environment, every single house or every single block of flats has got its own little satellite dish. And you think, why don't you just get together and have one on the roof if you want it that bad, you know, share it. But they don't. And that's a symptom of where we're at with it, which is absolutely, it's turn inwards, fear the neighbours, trust the TV. That's your life. We'll look after you.
And basically, I think that the fundamental approach has to be to make energetic progress in the other direction. Whenever you can sort out just exactly what it is they have in mind, like living by in your own front door with your own satellite dish and your own washing machine, then concluding that doing exactly the other thing might be a really good idea. Might make you a non-violent extremist, but it'd probably save you quite a lot of money and make you some new friends.
Yeah, that non-violent extremist thing's quite interesting, isn't it? I'm a very good friend who we've spoken already, Dr. Nick Collistrom. When that buffoon Cameron announced that he was going to be targeting non-violent extremists, Dr. Nick took himself off to New Scotland Yard and actually gave himself up for arrest, saying, "I am a non-violent extremist, you better arrest me." And they took it all, I think, tongue-in-cheek, but quite po-faced, and don't know all the details down, and oddly released him, but fair play to him to go and do it. But yeah, I mean, what nonsense. I mean, yes, we have to say no to this. I mean, for God's sake, thought crime, which is what Pippa was talking about before, pre-crime, you can be arrested for things you've not yet done, things that you've not yet thought about but you might, things you might talk to people about. Hello, how much clearer does it need to be, folks?
I mean, and as it is, there are the vast majority of the arrests and the finings and the chargings and all the other things are for people who have definitely caused nobody any harm, loss or damage. And now they're effectively going to be nicking people for not causing harm, loss and damage. I mean, I think you made a good point about the television, and the problem isn't actually with the medium, it's being how it's being used. But you must be, being in the business, as it were, you must be more aware than anybody else of how the setting, the lighting, the where people are sat and things like that really affect the way people think about them. That actually, to a great extent, the presentation is actually more important than the content. The content almost doesn't matter, it's how you put it across. Do you think it is crucial?
The Italians say the first bite is with the eyes, and that's absolutely true. My dad used to say, yes, it's shit, but it's beautifully cooked. and that's exactly it. Yes, it's how you present something. And, you know, the Babylon Bullshit Corporation are past masters at this. They're very, very good at cooking up any old crap, but doing it in such a believable way, the vast majority will accept it hook, line and sinker. And they've been doing it very successfully since 1922. You know? Conning the masses.
Well, you seem to me to be doing a... I haven't had time to go through the whole menu of what we've got on here. Perhaps I will before the end of the show, because it is you've got a very interesting bunch of speakers on. You've been doing quite a good job over the last few years about gathering people together, filming them, and then putting out DVDs for people to watch. How do you feel... Well, how did it start, and how do you feel the project's going?
Well, as you well know, sir, it started with you and I in a field at Utu some many years ago now. How's it going? It's a good job I don't have dollar signs in my eyes, because I'd have given up a long time ago. And again, if I look at it too closely, and it's a little like that thing in Douglas Adams. It says, how do you fly? You throw yourself at the ground and miss, and don't ever notice that you're not doing it.
Yeah.
If you notice you're flying, that's it, you'll be on the deck again. And it's a bit like that for us. We just crack on, try not to look too closely at the fact that we shouldn't be flying at all, and just keep going, really. But yeah, check us out on the site, pentos.tv. I have had the great good fortune to have been connected with some absolutely astonishingly interesting folks. You're very good self, highly among them. And they keep wanting to hang out and do these things together, and all power to them, and I hope they will continue to do so. But yeah, check it out. We're putting them out there. Just see what you fancy and have a go.
So this obviously is going to be a cracking weekend, I think. Like I say, I'll go through the full menu in a few minutes or so. But have you got any idea where you're going to go next? Is this it for the year? Or I suppose you're going to get a lot of material. It's going to take you a lot of time to actually manage the stuff that comes from here, isn't it? Can you do mine first, please?
I'll definitely do yours first, Nick, yeah. I will... We are having a wonder about maybe doing an event in the winter time, because although it's lovely doing stuff in the summertime, it just feels like a very, very long time between October and sort of June again. So we're thinking we might put something on in the dead of winter, around the winter solstice. So watch this space. But absolutely, yes, I'll see to it that yours is done very first. So
basically, then you need to have kind of indoor stuff. You can't have, not even these nutters would be camping out in the snow, I don't think. But well, that's really great, John. Thank you very much. Well, again, we'll be paying close attention to your talk, and if more questions come up, which I'm pretty sure they will, then perhaps you'll come back on for an hour or so, and we can look into it in a bit more detail. But thanks for very much giving up bar time to come and talk to us tonight.
My very great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for having me.
No problem. Your next mission, should you choose to accept it, is to go to the bar and get me a pint of Black Horse Stout. That'd be absolutely awesome. Thank you very much. So that was... I have got a glass here somewhere. Here it is. Oh, hold on. Excuse me one moment, guys. I must finish this pint. Hold on. Thank you. So you've been listening to John Colonel Kilgore Adams of Pentos TV, and... Next up is going to be Nick Collerstrom, who will be talking to us about his talk, which is called Did We Really Go to the Moon? And I expect there'll probably be a bit of activity in the chat box over that one. But we'll bang on another tune in the meantime. This is another of my favourites. I think I first heard the Jar Family at the Landed Festival in mid-Wales. And this is their tune Jet. This is their tune Debt. So get ready for some guitar. That was the Jar Family and Debt from their album, the Jar Family album. And I'm now joined by Dr. Nick Collerstrom, a proper doctor, And he's actually written about many subjects I know on the internet, but recently he's put three or four chapters, I think it's, together to a book called And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either, which has got Jim Fetzer and Mike Palachik's name on it. Nick, let's have a go at this chapter. Did they visit the moon? Doubts over Apollo. What are the doubts? I mean, what are people suggesting?
Yeah. Hi there, Nick. Good to be talking with you again. Last time was at the Big Green Gathering, wasn't it? We tried to do something about the heavens and the world harmony. Well, more and more people are just not believing this story. I mean, was it the great achievement of the 20th century that America went to the moon? As we were told, we were given this glorious story, and I've tended to believe it, okay, after all these years, but as more and more years go by, it becomes inherently more and more improbable. If 1972 was the last time anyone went out into deep space, you know, we're talking about through the Van Allen belt into outer space, why hasn't anyone done it since? We hear about, you know, the space station. Well, that's only 100 miles up. That is protected. The huge magnetic field of the Earth, the Van Allen radiation belts, they protect us from deadly outer space radiation, make life on Earth possible. Now, could the Apollo astronauts, way, way back in 1968, could they simply go through that radiation belt and go round the moon and come back? And apparently, you know, it's like a breeze, that they weren't harmed or anything.
And do we really know that the Van Allen belt is there?
I thought so, but Van Allen discovered it, and they did send up Geiger counters and stuff. So there's been loads of satellites that have gone up through it and since then. But nothing living. There's been all sorts of satellites measuring the magnetic field and radiation. Oh, we certainly do, yeah. And we know that they expand and grow stronger during a sunspot maximum. And that was just 1968, 69, when they supposedly went out. That was a sunspot maximum. Now, any kind of sensible moon program would have chosen a sunspot minimum for fairly obvious reasons. You don't want the terrific storms of the sun to give you this radiation, explosive high-energy radiation. And it charges up the Van Allen belts. They become much more charged with this high-energy solar plasma. If they were going to sail through it, which they did on Apollo 8 in December 1968, surely they would have sent some pilot craft beforehand, with apparatus and a monkey or something to see if it survived. That's what you'd normally expect for something totally unheard of and unprecedented, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they didn't do that.
And it is true, isn't it, that none of the astronauts, I mean, if they were going through this radiation experience, you'd expect quite a high degree of physical trauma over time. And they seem to have stayed pretty well, haven't they, by and large?
Well, yeah, that's another problem people find quite hard to believe. They seem to live on into their 70s. Not one of them got the big C from radiation damage. Ultimately, Nick, the important question concerns our future rather than our past. Is there a future of the human race going into space? Okay, now, I hope there is. I like to think this could help to resolve troubles on Earth. If there is an interplanetary future this century, if we can get out to the Moon and Mars. Now, a lot of people believe, who don't believe in the moon journeys to Apollo to the moon, that you would need 1 foot of lead to protect you against...
Take a bit of a rocket to launch that one, wouldn't it?
Well, that is the question. Or else maybe 10 feet of water to protect you against high-energy solar radiation. Now, NASA keeps saying that it's planning future missions. And occasionally it talks about the need to research the high-energy solar radiation and space radiation in order to be able to do that. And so people are answering back, well, didn't they do that way back in the 60s when they could apparently send people out?
And so we've got the radiation belts, we've got the fact that none of them actually got sick, and actually it is rumoured, isn't it, that actually being in space, being with zero gravity and stuff, they would expect that to have some kind of physical effect on people.
Oh, well, all that can be researched on the space station, Nick. I mean, weeks of zero gravity, obviously the bones grow thinner and everything, but that wasn't really a problem. This was just, we're talking about a few days in space, and they would be on the moon, and the suits they wore on the moon don't look as if they would give too much radiation protection, you know? And I remember going to the Science Museum, seeing this nose cone that apparently they came back in, you know? And it looked a very small, tinny little thing, and it did really strain my credulity that either it managed to come back in that and splash down, or that it could protect them against the radiation levels.
So we've got the Van Allen belts. Do people have any other problems with this idea about the men going to the moon? Have they got any other objections?
Oh, God, yeah, that's just the start of it. I mean, look at the pictures of them on the moon. Most of the pictures of them walking on the moon are said to resemble normal walking on Earth if you speed it up by times two, right? You just speed up the pictures of the moonwalk and the moon buggy, and then it looks fairly normally as if you're on Earth. Now, people find that rather peculiar. Also, they're supposed to be in 1/6 gravity. Now, were we shown anything about this 1/6 gravity? Wearing the heavy rucksacks, they should have been able to jump at least 3 times higher than normal, okay? And I think it's fair to say we didn't really see that, did we? So there are people having doubts. Also, I won't go into technical questions about the photographs. A lot of people feel the shadows are rather peculiar, or that people are too brightly illuminated. I don't feel those are so conclusive, these arguments about light and shadow, because it would all look very, very different on the moon without any atmosphere, and the sun was reflecting off the lunar surface. So if some bits are rather brighter than we think they should be, this could be the anomalous effects of the sun shining on the lunar surface, possibly.
Is it possible, do you think, that they did go there and they did take photographs, but the photographs we're seeing are not the photographs that were taken?
Well, that's a good point. I think you're implying what we might call Plan B. Just suppose President Kennedy said they had to go to the moon in 1963, something like 200,000 people working on this project, absolutely vast project, and the story is, did they halfway through realise that actually they couldn't do it? What was there a Plan B? Now, the argument is that every step of that moon voyage was rehearsed and practiced and simulated. You know, being on the moon, there's a whole lab for simulating that to get the astronauts used to it all. And then the horrible doubt creeps in. Were these simulations, photographs of simulations, what we actually saw? You know, how do you actually tell the difference between simulated pictures and actually being in space and going out there? And one possible angle here, Nick, is what you and I were talking about earlier, that the astronauts haven't really said a lot that is humanly meaningful to people. I mean, proverbially, they were terrified of being asked the question, what did it feel like to be on the moon? You know? Now, you could say, oh, these are military people. Of course, NASA's a military organisation. And they were trained to iron out their feelings. There was some story that when they came back from the moon, they could remember in detail all the operating instructions they'd been given, exactly the sequence of what they'd been told to do, but they couldn't access their own feelings at all. And one of them tried to get himself psychoanalyzed to try and remember the feelings he'd had when he was on the moon. Well, that's a rather peculiar situation. So I think there's a lack of a sense of human meaning and human communication that people felt from these lunar astronauts. It's quite hard to say what to make of that. Personally, I never felt the astronauts were skilled in deception. I felt they were straightforward guys who'd been given instructions, told what to do. And looking at their faces and the way they spoke, I personally didn't sense any hint of deception, especially not with Neil Armstrong.
It is pretty amazing, isn't it, that what must have been a pretty extraordinary experience doesn't seem to be commented on and thought, maybe we can take it that they're military guys and that we know that effectively they're taken apart, aren't they, and then rebuilt for a military role. But it still seems pretty stunning that they weren't left with... Because we're electromagnetic beings, we've got all these hormones, we've got all these chemicals running out around our body. Actually going out to the moon and then walking on it and then coming all the way back, I would expect there to be some kind of desire to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, supposing somebody's agitated about the flag fluttering on the moon. That's a big story, okay?
Yeah.
Did the American flag flutter when it's planted on the moon when there's supposed to be no wind? And the counter argument there is, oh, it only fluttered when it was being planted there, when there were hands on the flag putting it there. Now, I'd have thought that was something that the astronauts could chat about in a TV show without being threatened. I'd have thought that's the kind of thing. And also, the kind of things we mentioned earlier. Are the photographs somehow too good? Or do they look like carefully staged photos? Bear in mind, the cameras they had were strapped onto their chest, and they couldn't look through any eyepiece prior to taking the photos, okay? All they could do is press the button and click. So how come these photographs are so perfectly in focus and beautifully framed? You know, that is one thing that people have a problem with. And this is the kind of thing that we might have expected there to be astronauts willing to talk about it. You know, a bit of give and take, as if it didn't threaten them. But it's more as if that they are threatened by this, you know.
Yeah, so... kind of on balance, what is your conclusion? Do you think they did go or didn't they go?
Well, I'm not an oracle, Nick, but...
You're close to an oracle as we've got.
Well, also, I've always been fascinated by the moon. My PhD was about lunar astronomy, let me just say that. I got fascinated, and my mum was a chemist, in the detail about the moon rock they brought back, okay? And the moon rock was unique. They had huge chemical symposia from people analysing the different bits of moon rock they'd been given. For example, if I may give an there was much higher proportion of iron on the lunar surface, 5% on Earth, 15% on the moon. So you wouldn't expect that at all from a very light body, the moon. The moon is paradoxically light, very low density. Some people wonder if it's hollow and all that. Okay, so this large amount of iron had a very, very low level of nickel. Now, the iron-nickel ratio is very crucial, or not very crucial, very characteristic. Characteristic for Earth, about 1 to 50 or something, and it's different for meteorites. Meteorites have more like 1 to 20. So that tells you about, well, it allows theories about the origin of the Earth and so on. Now, the moon rock had much, much lower nickel, 1 in 20,000 or so on. Now, this isn't the sort of thing you can easily make up. You can't easily produce rock with iron in it having that very low nickel content. And also, it wouldn't occur to you. It's not something that would occur to you. Also, very high-precision laboratories analysing the moon rock, they called it Genesis rock, older than anything on Earth. Why did they call it that? They called it that because the high... all the different lead isotopes that were present in that rock. It wasn't just the ordinary lead we have on Earth. All different isotopes... and theory is that all the heavier elements, such as uranium, decay slowly and end up producing a lead isotope. That's the end product of their decay process, okay? And geologists measure millions of years of the Earth's age using these lead isotopes. And the more lead is present in the rock, the more age. So the whole inference of enormous age of the moon rocks came from these lead isotopes. That isn't the kind of thing you would either think of or that you could, do. You couldn't produce that in samples of... and you have, this isn't a conspiracy. These are chemistry labs around the world agreeing on this. Okay? And generally speaking, low boiling point elements such as sodium and potassium were fractionated out from the rock, as if the rock somehow came from some early proto-Earth, but had those elements, went through some heat process, intense heat process, to have those low boiling point elements fractionated out. Also, they found no trace of water in the moon rocks, not even hydrated compounds. So, I could go on. There were very characteristic and fascinating features of this lunar rock, quite different from Earth rock. So I don't accept the view that it was somehow picked up from the Antarctic or something. I've always accepted that they really did dig this up from the lunar surface. So, supposing you've got, if you want to say, well, couldn't I have a robot do that? You've got somebody dig up quite a large amount, allegedly nearly 400 kilograms of lunar rock, brought back successive missions. You've got things left on the moon, such as laser mirror reflectors and stuff, and things to measure moonquakes, for example, bits of apparatus left on the moon. It all gets rather complicated if you want to imagine that some computer left, some robots went and left that there, okay?
Yeah. It's 400 kilos. That's a whole lot of rock. That's the best part of half a ton of rock. Very, very difficult to imagine where else it might have come from, it has to be said. In terms of the tackle that's been left lying around on the moon, one of my favourite stories, as an individual who does believe that they went there, although I'm not sure they use rocket ships and I'm not sure the photos we're seeing are the photos they took, but one of the stories I like is that one of the Apollo missions left a thing for measuring resonance, because they wanted to see how often the moon was being impacted on, and the tale has it that they launched their own booster rocket at the moon, that it hit the moon, and that it took the moon something like 45 minutes to reach its frequency, and that NASA actually said that the moon rings like a bell.
I want to confirm that. It rang like a bell for about 3 hours. They dropped something onto the lunar surface. And this shows a very dry structure. On Earth, earthquakes and tremors last a few minutes. Moon has some sort of dry resonant structure to it, yeah. So I believe these investigations did really take place. And, last but not least, let's remember something called the LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, in about 2009, 2012, went and orbited around the moon close up and took high-resolution pictures. And that is claiming to be able to see the Apollo landing sites. And it's claiming to see, I think, is it five out of the six? Is it six times they landed? Five out of six, they can see traces or indications even of the flags that were planted. Now, a lot of people don't believe anything America comes out from America. So let's point out that also India claims to launch its own satellite, which orbited around the moon for about a year and took photographs before finally crashing on the moon. And that, again, was fairly recently. And that also has claimed to have photographed the remains of the Apollo sites.
Have we seen any of these photos?
Well, they're up on the web. I mean, I'll be showing it tomorrow and see what the audience, my audience, thinks of it. They are up on the web. If you want to claim that they're fiddling with the photos and putting that in, well, that's all getting rather far-fetched. And they must realise if they are fiddling that sooner or later it's going to have a catastrophic effect.
I think it's actually quite easy for people to tell when digital tampering has happened with pictures nowadays, isn't it? So if they were being fiddled with, I think it would be detectable.
This is you may feel it's somewhat unsatisfactory what I'm saying, that I've taken the view that they did actually go there, but a lot of things do seem very hard to believe, or meet outright incredulity, and I can't honestly answer the question about, for future missions into space, can they go out as Apollo astronauts seem to go out with virtually no protection against space radiation, or do they need some enormously heavy, perhaps prohibitively heavy, protection against radiation? I think these are questions, hopefully, that will be answered in our lifetime. I think it's terribly important for the human race that it to have hope that it can go into space. Yeah. And for us to be able to look forward to a future in which missions to the moon and Mars are really feasible.
So, I guess our basic conclusion then, probably between us, is that they did go to the moon by whatever means, but that there does seem to be something dodgy going on, but we can't even really begin. It would actually be quite simple to say, oh, well, they just didn't go. What do you think? I mean, the fact that the moon rang for 3 hours after they shot something at it, it suggests to me that it's actually a hollow resonant structure of some sort. Is that reasonable?
Well, it hasn't got a magnetic core. The moon isn't magnetic. There are no heavy metals at the centre as there are for planet Earth, or we believe. And it's got very low density, and it's got the weird structure of having these heavy metals, uranium, titanium, iron, on the outside, which is incredibly strange. The huge seas you see, if you look at the man on the moon, picture of the man on the moon, when you see the full moon, there's enormous lava seas that you're looking at, charcoal dark, circular lava seas, and they are packed with these high melting point heavy metals. And it's absolutely bewildering and baffling, I think, for astronomers to figure out any theory of how they could have got there. And a lot of astronomers have wondered there might be caverns in the moon to account for its apparently quite low density.
And then it's got, I mean, the low density is one thing, because it's something like a third the size of the Earth and about an eighth of the mass, isn't it? Something like that. But then it's got the opposite problem of these massive concentrations of gravity that also seem to be centred under the seas. Do you know anything about them?
Well, yes, I'm glad you raised this extremely obscure concept. This is the currently accepted reason why the moon faces the Earth. Why does the moon ever face earthwards? What pulls it? There must be some gravity pull to make it face earthwards. It's very far away. It's 30 Earth diameters away from Earth. And by the way, the mass, I think, is 1 over 81 of the Earth.
Really?
One over 81.
Yeah.
Fourth power of 3. Yeah. And these mascons, what you referred to, are underneath the lava seas. Now, this is a part of the incredibly bizarre discoveries they made about the moon. That the seas, the once molten lava seas, are denser and heavier than the mountains. There's 5-mile-high mountains around these lava seas, which are less dense. Now, on Earth, obviously, mountains are much more dense than the oceans. Why on Earth would these now frozen lava seas that you see, when you look up at the man in the moon face, the lovely full moon image you see, those big dark areas are the lava seas, and they have, as Nick has just pointed out, these very heavy mass concentrations underneath them, presumed to be these heavy metals I mentioned earlier. What the hell are they doing? First of all, it's asymmetrical. They're on the side of the moon facing earthwards, not on the other side, okay? Those lava seas are not present at all on the other side. So those high density of those lava seas, underneath those lava seas, in a very light satellite of Earth, that is what, as it were, gravity gets a grip on to pull it so that it faces earthwards. So that's a pretty damn strange concept.
Certainly is, isn't it? Certainly is. And is there any truth, do you think, in this rumour that those lava seas are all at pretty much the same level? That they're all the same depth? That effectively what you've got is... the suggestion is that, for a start off, there aren't any craters in them, and all around them, you know, there appears to be either impact damage or the effect of electrical sparking on the moon. And yet there is absolutely none of that in the seas. And I'd read somewhere that all of the seas are actually at the same level. Is that correct, do you know?
Well, they could be. There were once molten. There are ghost craters that stick up through the seas. Ghost craters, yeah, in the sense that they were there before the seas and they've been flooded. So when the lava seas were molten, they flooded over a terrain that had craters in it, and you see bits sticking up the rim of the craters. I mean, everything about the moon is mysterious. I'll just point out the craters are all circular. There's no elliptical craters. Now, this means that they cannot have been formed by impacts of meteors, okay? If meteors were raining down, making those lunar craters, I don't know if your listeners want this obscure detail.
Go for it.
All right. The you would have had all sorts of elliptical shapes and sizes as they hit from all different angles. So the craters must have been formed, therefore, by some sort of process within the moon, not by external impact. And altogether, the moon is a mystery wrapped up in an enigma. And the question of one other thing we haven't mentioned, I don't know if you want to ask about, is whether the astronauts this is, you know, part of urban rumour, urban legend. Did they see some sort of either UFOs or remains of some past intelligent life there? I mean, that is quite a prevalent one, isn't it?
Well, that is something I'm pretty keen to ask about, because if, say, for example, we're not seeing the photographs they actually took on the moon, and what they found there was a whole load of stuff which, normally speaking, you would expect good capitalists to be mining and bringing back home to sell. So if they didn't go back and the photographs aren't quite what they actually saw up there, it does lead me to suspect that they might have seen things that, I mean, it's known, isn't it, that it's felt by the world management team that if the world population were to find out that there were extraterrestrial races or a bigger history than one we've got, then there'd be total panic and stuff, and they do seem to want to keep it secret.
Yeah, well, okay, let me conjecture here, Nick. I feel like NASA has betrayed its core mission statement to seek out signs of intelligent life outside the Earth, and that it has come across quite a bit of evidence, both on the Moon and on Mars, for this, and has covered it up, has airbrushed it out. And I heard a moderately reliable story that during the Apollo missions, the astronauts had two different radio frequencies they would report back on, and when they had something about any UFOs or saw stuff they shouldn't have seen, they would switch over. And famously, one of the Apollo missions, when they went around the back of the moon, they reappeared saying, "We've seen Father Christmas," or something like that. I think they did see all sorts of signs, either of present alien life or of past signs of alien life. And likewise, especially on Mars, I think there's loads of residue, especially that Sardona area, maybe extinct cultures that had lived there. And I think for the human race to have hope for the future, we need some space program that will not lie to us about this. I mean, these might be some remains of the Earth, some earlier forgotten phase of the great human adventure. We don't know where we came from, where the human race came from. And these signs, or should we say residual stuff on the Moon and Mars, might be important for this.
Do you think such investigations are being undertaken and the results just not being made public, perhaps?
Well, I'd say there's a general feeling that we might believe what Russian scientists said on this matter a lot more than we'd believe American ones. We all know the way NASA was a military project. Military procedures and definitions governed what people were allowed to say, and that fatally undermines our confidence in what they tell us. That's the terrible thing. We need a civilian project of getting into space, which is open to what is found. But science is supposed to be an enterprise where we look and discover what is there. We don't initially want to define and limit what we find, none of us can avoid the suspicion that those lunar astronauts, now in their old age, did see stuff that they weren't allowed to tell us about.
Nodon, I think it was, in the chat box, has asked us whether you think that the moon was formed from the Earth's crust. And one of the things I'm aware of about the moon is that nearly all explanations of how something so large in size can have actually ended up there in the first place. Where do you think it originated?
Well, scientists, I think they're totally baffled by this question, and they've been through about four different theories. I mean, the original, for a long time, there was a theory that came out from the Pacific Ocean, you know, and that the ring of fire around the Pacific Ocean was the remains of the moon emerging. And then that was the first theory, that was the first real theory of where the moon had come from. And it was found that the system as a whole didn't have enough angular momentum for that to have happened. Because so that theory had to be abandoned. Now, and then they had a capture theory, and that wouldn't work. They discovered with the Apollo missions that the moon is a very nearly circular orbit around us, and any capture theory would be very elliptical. It's very hard to get a circular orbit like that. It's full of paradoxes, however you try to theorise about it. But to try and do my best answering this question, there is a ratio of three different oxygen isotopes in Earth crust and on the Moon, which is sufficiently similar to convince astronomers and science geologists that the moon came from some sort of early proto-Earth. It did not come from outer space. It was not captured. Mm-hmm. It has to have come from somewhere somewhat similar to wherever the Earth came from, yeah, because of that similarity of the three oxygen isotopes. That is, I think, one of the things that they will agree on. Yeah.
So it's been, because the moon's been a subject of interest to me for some 20 years or so, and it is my feeling that out of all the anomalous things we see around us, and God knows there's enough of them, that the moon is probably the most anomalous thing known to man. With your PhD in lunar astrology, would you think that's a fair comment?
There is nothing more mysterious in the world, and anomalous, than the moon. You're absolutely right. I certainly agree with that. There was an amusing essay by Isaac Asimov, which went through the different moons in all the solar system, and concluded that there's only one problem with theory, that moon out there should not exist at all. It really shouldn't be in that orbit, so far away from us, yet with a nearly perfectly circular orbit. It's got no business thing there. And why on earth does it face us all the time? It's the absolute opposite of Earth. It's apparently more or less bone dry, and Earth has, Earth is renewed by water all of the time. It's got no magnetic field. Earth has got quite a huge magnetic field, and it's got no independent rotation of its own, and the Earth has. So in many ways, it's there's no sign of any life, inherent life of its own on it. There's no biological life on it. So it's incredibly opposite to the Earth. And yet it forever faces us, and it gives us this wonderful enigma.
Do we know of anything else in the solar system or elsewhere that faces the planet that it's orbiting?
Well, I think Pluto and its moon Charon are locked in phase lock together like that, in the same way. But the point is that the moon is so far away from us that there's no easy way in which gravity theory would explain it facing us. I think that is the problem. To be in a nearly circular orbit like it is, it should be much nearer to us to be held properly by Earth's gravity fields. Okay.
So whether or not they went to the moon might be a moot point, but we can certainly be sure that the moon is about the weirdest thing we've come across, and the buggers should be going back there to find out why that's the case.
Yeah, well, let's hope. They might be my home in a country like China, possibly. Let's talk of it having a space programme. We want some country whose word we can believe in to go into deep space. This is the thing. America has so fatally compromised itself by fabricating of deceptions. I'm sorry to have to say this, but I mean... Or even British scientists. Do you believe British astronomers? Say, Jodrell Bank, for example, claims to have followed the Apollo missions all the way out to the moon with its radar, antennae and stuff, you know. Now, do you believe an assurance like that? Okay? Now, I suppose I have believed in a thing like that, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people, oh, well, of course they would tell you that, wouldn't they? And so it is very much a crisis of do people believe authority anymore?
And it does seem that the number of people who believe that we didn't go to the moon is increasing quite rapidly now.
Yeah, last year the Telegraph did a survey. It found that one in four people didn't believe it. And I think you got similar figures from America. Now, I remember 20th century, it was one in 10 people didn't believe. About one in 10 were sceptical. And bear in mind that Britain and America are the countries where you'd expect most people to believe it. So Muslim countries, you get far higher proportion, just don't believe it at all. You know, so I think scientists should recognise that there is a real crisis of confidence here, and it's a question of public communication. If they're capable of giving talks or assurances that they did go to the moon, then I damn well think they ought to try and do it.
So we might conclude that NASA definitely does stand for never a straight answer. In fact, I suggested they should have a new motto, which went something like, NASA, feck me, we weren't expecting that.
Or what was it? Need another seven astronauts after the space shuttle disorder. Well, look, Greg, Mr. Greg Hallett's here. Should we ask him the big question?
Just before we move on, we'll have a bit of music, then move on to Greg. Just before that, I'd like to ask you about, we did talk about this earlier on today. I have been really, really struck by the number of people I'm stumbling across who suddenly seem to believe that the Earth is flat. As a geometer, an amateur geometer and a bit of a bluffer geometer, I find this more or less impossible to believe myself. Well, actually impossible to believe, I'll be frank. And I'm just amazed at the speed with which it seems to be... as a doctor with a PhD in lunar astronomy and stuff like that, do you think the Earth might be flat?
Can you have a PhD in lunar astronomy?
Well, likewise, Dr. Rock, I never in my entire life I met anyone who thought the Earth was flat until a few months ago. And suddenly, you're getting this all over the place. Oh, do you realise? They've been conning us all this time, and so on. And perhaps this follows on from what we were saying about disbelief in authority. I mean, you're suddenly getting people thinking, oh, right. And this is the world, in a sense, it's the world that you experience. Say we're in a summer camp, it looks like a nice flat horizon above us, and the clouds above us aren't moving, and it looks like we're on a stationary Earth. That is the primordial experience, and you go back 2,500 years, the Book of Isaiah or whatever, and it's a flat Earth, okay? I am baffled, as far as I make out, if you want my opinion, it comes from a kind of optical illusion. There's a claim that if you look over a 6-mile stretch of water, you should be able to see perceptible curvature of the Earth. Quite a lot, whereas actually you can see the water looks flat and you can see the other side without any bulge in the middle. I think there is an optical refraction effect here that the light is slightly bent due to the water vapour. But as far as I know, until just going from Wikipedia, the experiments have been done over the last 100 years quite carefully and written up. It's called the Bedford Flats Experiment. And published, that they did show the curvature as predicted, but a bit less than was expected because of this refraction effect.
So is the Bedford Flats experiment the one where the guy stood in the canal with a telescope and watched a boat retreating from him, and expected it to disappear over the horizon and it didn't, or have I got the wrong investigation there?
Well, I don't think it was quite that. They stuck up poles. They stuck up poles at each end with markers on them, and you should have seen the markers lining up or not lining up. I think that was how they did the experiment. But if you look across the channel, what I remember as a kid, you saw the ships first appearing. You first saw the chimney in the top of the ship, and then the rest of the ship came into view, and that's because you're looking at the curvature of the Earth. I thought there was abundant evidence for that. But just if there are any flat earthers listening, I could just comment. I suggest staying up one night and watching the stars. You'll see they all revolve. They all rise one horizon and revolve around and set the other. And they revolve around the pole star. And that is the axis of the Earth that you're looking at. And it's not the stars moving, it is the Earth. Okay, you're looking at the Earth revolving on its axis. And if you go, say, further south, go to the Mediterranean, you'll notice that pole star is now lower on your horizon. That's because of the curvature of the Earth, okay? And if you go south, beyond the equator, you won't be able to see the pole star at all. You see the other end of the heavens. You see the Southern Cross. And again, you see all the stars revolving around. Now, that is your primal, simple experience of the curvature of the Earth. And that is why there's never been any astronomer in history who has supported a flat Earth theory, okay? Absolutely none.
And it would be quite difficult even to account for something like sunrise and sunset and the moving shadow across the surface of the Earth if it wasn't for the fact that it's a sphere, I would have thought.
Well, it's what bemoans me. I've got a really intelligent friend of mine, science degree and everything, and he suddenly starts telling me about, oh, the Earth's flat, and don't you realise this is the big secret? And apparently they believe that the sun and moon are quite small and move around above us somehow, and that they don't see it. So I agree with you. I think it's a bit of a mystery. Why does the sky get dark at night?
So that's brilliant. Thank you very much. That's because I agree with what you've been saying. Even though I don't know anything, and it's really great to have somebody along who has actually done a bit of study into it and understands a bit of the dynamics. Because of course you wrote your the beautiful book on the beauty of Venus. So you've looked way beyond the moon and understand how Mercury works and all that kind of stuff. So I'd sooner take your word than anybody else's. We have got plenty of flat earthers in the chat box though. Just as a matter of interest, you put four chapters into the and I suppose we didn't go to the moon anyway. Either book. What were your other three chapters on? Just quickly before I let you go.
One was on Osama bin Laden, how he died. He died 2001, wasn't it? So that's about the 9/11 story. Another one's about the Holocaust, you know, yeah. Holocaust story that Jim wanted.
I'm afraid we can't talk about that.
Definitely not. No, no way. Another one was about the Beatles story with Paul McCartney, and did he die and was he replaced? So these are all sort of humdingers that Jim kindly allowed me to write about.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, I shall make sure I get a copy of the book. I shall read your chapters in it, and it'd be really great if you'd come on again and talk to us. In the meantime, I'm looking forward to your chat, your talk over the weekend, and hopefully I'll get a chance to record that. We'll get a bit more detail off you. But in the meantime, Dr. Nicholas Collerstrom, thank you very much for being a guest on Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com, and have a cracking weekend, sir.
Okay.
Brilliant. So, as I said, that was Dr. Nick Collerstrom talking about whether or not people went to the moon. A very interesting tale, that one, that hopefully we'll be seeing a lot more about as time goes by. And maybe eventually we'll even discover whether the Earth is flat. So I'm going to play 7 minutes or so of music. We're going to kick off with Litmus and No Tax for War. Stick your tax up your cracks, your government whores. Go, Litmus. ProjectFreeman.com is his site. Johnny Cash and the Cats in the Cradle Air. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we're discussing stuff with several people from the Harlequin Fair over in the east of England. And coming up next is Greg Hallett, and he's going to be talking here about the hidden king of England. And if you think some of the stuff we've been hearing so far is bizarre, then Greg's really on one, in my opinion. Greg, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here at the Harlequin Fair. Jonathan Adams invited me to his talk, and you have now successfully hijacked for him.
So a hidden king. I mean, some people might ask, do we need any more aristocracy? Do we need any more royalty?
Well, within living memory, you've had non-aristocracy, non-royals as your monarchs. And the British royal family has been illegitimate from their births from 1840 on.
Well, no wonder they've been... I've noticed, I've just been to look at the Skype, and it's still not online. So even though we're holding the stream, we've got the chat box running, everything's working fine. For some reason, the Skype just isn't working. I think they didn't like the sound of some of the subjects we were going to be covering tonight. So what on earth makes you suggest that our beloved Queen might be illegitimate?
Well, not only is Queen Elizabeth II illegitimate, King George V is illegitimate, and King Edward VII is illegitimate. So if we look at what happened, we have to go back to 1815, to the Battle of Waterloo. And in the Battle of Waterloo, the Duke of Wellington was fighting for the British, leading the British against the French and Napoleon. And the battle was rigged, and both Wellington and Napoleon were Rothschild agents. And the...
No, surely not!
It couldn't be, possibly. No, yes, but it's true. It was all planned for the final battle to be in Waterloo, and the Rothschilds had bred homing pigeons from carrier pigeons. They'd bred homing pigeons from Waterloo, which is about 10-20 kilometres south of Brussels, and they had bred these new homing pigeons to fly from Waterloo to bank in London, and they'd done that from 1814. So when they had the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, in June, the homing pigeons flew the message to Bank in London, which was about a day quicker than the horse-riding pony express and catching a boat across the water. And Nathan Mayer Rothschild had the wrong result of the war attached to the pigeons, just in case one of them got lost or found. So the homing pigeons carried the message Napoleon had won, and that message was taken down to the commodity bourse or stock exchange, and all the British sold their shares. And then Nathan Mayer Rothschild had his agents buy up the shares, and then the Pony Express brought in the true message that the Duke of Wellington had won the war, the Battle of Waterloo. And that's how Napoleon made... Nathan Mayer Rothschild made the bulk of his money, and that amount is still not disclosed. And the British royal family were virtually bankrupt from then on in, and the Rothschilds agreed to finance the British royal family's weddings in exchange for the breeding rights. So Queen Victoria's mother, Princess Victoire Louise, she ended up having a threesome, or otherwise known as in the cult circles, as a Merovingian bestia Neptuni procreation tradition with Nathan Mayer Rothschild and his...
Also known as a ménage à trois.
with Nathan Mayer Rothschild and his youngest brother, Baron Jacob Mayer de Rothschild. And the youngest brother, Baron Jacob Mayer de Rothschild's seed took hold, and that resulted in Princess Victoria, who became Queen Victoria, who was illegitimate. Princess Victoria found out the secret at a young age and decided to counteract it by secretly getting pregnant to and then marrying blind Prince George of Cumberland, who was the second in line to the throne. They were married on the 9th of March, 1834, in Mont-Saint-Michel in Brittany, and then exactly 7 weeks later their legitimate child was born, Prince Marcos Manuel. And when Queen Victoria was in 1850, she wrote a letter to Prince Marcos Manuel saying, "Assemble him claimant." And then Queen Victoria made Prince Marcos Manuel King John II of England on the 6th of October 1869. So, Great Britain, United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, I'd like to tell you that you have a new king from 1869 to 1910.
And who's that then?
Prince Marcos Manuel. He was the true King of England. And as soon as... on the same day that Prince Marcos Manuel was made King John II of England, Queen Victoria marked this by opening the Holborn Viaduct and Blackfriars Bridge on the same day. And then Queen Victoria was relegated to Victoria Regina, Empress of India, and at the same time she began building a porch in front of Roslyn Chapel to show that the Sinclairs were porch monkeys.
Well, what?
Porch monkeys.
What's a porch monkey?
Porch monkey is someone who sits on a veranda and makes lots of noise as though they're the real thing, as though they own the porch or the building, but they don't.
So for several generations, it would appear our monarchy are commoners, are they?
Yeah, they're so illegitimate now that the entity known as Queen Elizabeth II is actually a commoner. But we can get to that. Marcos Manuel, Prince Marcos Manuel, Queen Victoria's legitimate, only legitimate, and firstborn son, and firstborn child, he became the King of England, King John II of England in 1869, and he died on the 1st of April 1910, and he was poisoned by his younger half-brother, 7.5 years younger, and that was King Edward VII. So King Edward VII died 5 weeks later, so he was only actually ever king for 5 weeks, and that was due to regicide. And then he, King Edward VII, converted to Catholicism on his deathbed and thereby disinherited all of his progeny, including King George V.
So where does that leave us as a nominal constitutional monarchy, with somebody who's supposedly signing bills into acts and all the rest of it? What does all this mean for us?
Well, okay, I can tell you what it means for you legally. You're up shit creek without a paddle. That's basically it. And all of the countries that have been given legitimacy from England, like Israel, is up shit creek without a paddle. It has no legitimacy because England can't grant that legitimacy. But I think we should look at the subsequent illegitimacy of the British royal family after King Edward VII. So King Edward VII, he regicided, which means murdered. He regicided his elder, 7.5 year elder brother, legitimate King John II of England. King John II was king from the 6th of October 1869 to the 1st of April 1910. 5 weeks later, King Edward VII died, and we're into a fake royal line. And then King George V became the King of England from 1910 to 1936. And King George V was illegitimate. He was the son of Tsarevich Sasha, who became Tsar Alexander III of Russia. And his son, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, was actually half-brother to King George V. And there's a photo of them standing next to each other, and they look identical. They are the same height, same facial structure, same beards. They absolutely look like brothers, if not twins. They were also first cousins, but most importantly, they were half-brothers and first cousins. So King George V died in 1936, and he was not a legitimate king because he was illegitimate, but also his elder brother, Prince Eddie, was still alive and living in Glamis Castle. And King George V's son, Edward VIII, knew that when his father died, when King George V died, Prince Eddie was still alive, and that was one of the reasons why Edward VIII abdicated. So Edward VIII did his best to destroy the British monarchy in order to provide some integrity. And he destroyed the monarchy by having at least 50 illegitimate children and marrying a double divorcee who was a spy and had undescended testes.
Wallace Simpson. I find it quite interesting that we kicked off with King John II, given that King John I was the guy who handed over the crown to the Vatican in the first place and ensured that even if the monarchy was legitimate, it was basically a vassal to Rome.
I think that the material that's been written on the Magna Carta, etc., and on King John I is very dubious. And the Catholics have a tradition of writing up history hundreds of years after it happened, as though it happened in their favour. And I really don't think that we've got to the bottom of the Magna Carta or what King John I was like.
So, given, as you say, under these conditions, in legal terms, we're, as you say, up shit creek without a paddle, are you finding any solutions to that? I mean, is there a way of dealing with this situation as individuals from your perspective?
Yeah, there is, and I'm finding some, and I'm coming up against very large brick walls, which are paper thin. They're not actually brick walls, they just look like brick walls. But I think what we should do is just do a rundown on the illegitimacy. I'll continue with that. So we've got Edward VIII, who is not crowned king, so he's not King Edward VIII, he's just Edward VIII. He was never a king, and he was in that position unfulfilled from January to December 1936. And then we had King George VI, who was, he had one IQ point above retarded, 67 IQ, he had knock knees, terrible stutter, and the King's speech is based around him. And he was an alcoholic and a chain smoker. And he thought he married Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, but he didn't. He married Elizabeth Bowes Lyon's maid. And this is actually a repeat of history from Jacob, who thought he was marrying Rachel, but he married Rachel's sister, right? So it's almost portentous. So what happened was about 1921, Elizabeth Bowes Lyon was engaged for a week to Edward VIII, the person who became Edward VIII. And then Edward VIII said that he was going to abdicate. So Elizabeth Bowes Lyon next week was engaged to the person who became King George VI. And
makes one think that Elizabeth Bowes Lyon might have been the important individual in that particular equation.
No, Elizabeth Bowes Lyon had no royalty at all. The reason was that her father, Lord Glamis, had been taking care of Prince Eddie while he was alive in the world's longest bed and breakfast, which lasted for over 40 years, from 1892 to past 1936. So Elizabeth Bowes Lyon was part of a high-level Freemasonry pact due to Lord Glamis taking care of Prince Eddie in Glamis Castle for over 40 years. Elizabeth Bowes Lyon was to marry a royal. She didn't have royal blood. She was to marry a royal. And when Elizabeth Bowes Lyon met the person who became King George VI, she said, well, she saw that he had knock knees, terrible stutter, he was a chain smoker, alcoholic, and kind of looked a bit frog-like. So she said no. She said no, and she got her maid to stand in and marry King George VI.
And he didn't notice this going on?
Well, he had a 67 IQ. His IQ was so low that when photographs were taken, his attention span had already run out, and he was often looking to the side or walking away, you know, so it was actually quite difficult to get a shot of King George VI. So King George VI ends up marrying Elizabeth Bowes Lyon's maid, and then Lord Louis Mountbatten comes along and says, oh, George VI, you've married Elizabeth Bowes Lyon's maid. What the? So here's what's going to happen. My pauper prince nephew, Prince Philip, is going to marry Princess Elizabeth. And they go, well, either we lose the monarchy. It was an extortion. Either we lose the monarchy or we let Princess Elizabeth marry Prince Philip, right? But the other thing that Lord Louis Mountbatten came up with was that King George VI did not sire Princess Elizabeth or Princess Margaret. So what happened was the person who became King George VI, via artificial insemination, sired a child with Elizabeth Bowes Lyon's maid, his wife. And that child was a boy and born epileptic, and they left it to die on the hospital gurney. So because George VI was so retarded, they decided to replace him as a sperm donor with an illegitimate royal, the illegitimate child of King Edward VII. And the illegitimate child of King Edward VII was Winston Churchill. So Winston Churchill became the sperm donor and impregnated via artificial insemination Elizabeth Bowes Lyon's maid, who was married to the person who became King George VI. So Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret are both the children of Winston Churchill, right? And that's interesting because when Winston Churchill and Hitler met, right, they did meet. They met in May 1940 in France. Hitler addressed Churchill and treated Churchill as though Churchill was the King of England, right, because Winston Churchill was the father of Princess Elizabeth, right, who was Princess Regent. So Princess Elizabeth was extorted into marriage by a CIA Nazi bisexual pedophile called Prince Philip, who was a pauper. He had £20 in his pocket and he owned two suits, right? And that is alluded to in Peter Pan, with the two raccoons being raconteurs and racketeers. And that first applied to Lord Lou Mountbatten's father and Lord Lou Mountbatten, and then it applied to Lord Lou Mountbatten and Prince Philip. And Prince Philip ended up ordering the murder of Lord Lou Mountbatten.
So you really sound like you've been doing your work here. Where did you find this stuff out, and what was it that first drew you into an interest in it? Because you don't necessarily look like the kind of man who'd have an intense interest in royalty. So, how did you follow all of this up? Did you find it in books, or did somebody from the moon come down and let you know?
well, we should probably talk about a little bit more about the illegitimacy, because it's quite important to get the whole story out, because the overall goal from 1840 on was to make the British royal family more and more and more illegitimate, until it was so completely obvious that they were illegitimate that no one could miss it, right?
And why were they doing that?
Because my lighter won't work.
Yeah, he's just lighting a fag here. It's getting late in the field, and we're sharing a microphone. Let's go. Here we go. I've got one. Here you go. Here's one that works. Yeah. We'll just address the important business of lighting the cigarette before we... And it also strikes me that Litmus wrote a really amazing song called No More, basically pointing out that all we've been doing all these years is fighting in cousins' bloody wars. Yeah. And apparently these people have no... Well, they have no authority anyway, but now they've got even more no authority.
Yeah. Otherwise known as even less authority.
Yeah.
Or no authority at all.
Yeah.
So we've got Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret are illegitimate, and Prince Philip has extorted Princess Elizabeth into marriage. So Lord Louis Mountbatten arranges that marriage on several conditions. And one of the conditions is that he has rights of sex, right, with the firstborn, which was Prince Charles. So Lord Lou Mountbatten was well known as a paedophile, and he was sodomising Prince Charles from a very young age. And there's photographs of Prince Charles as a four-year-old, six-year-old, sitting on Lord Louis Mountbatten's lap. And Lord Louis Mountbatten has a very big erection, right? It's running down his thigh, right next to Prince Charles' hand, right? And the whole family's just sitting around as though this was, like, normal. And Lord Lou Mountbatten sodomised virtually everyone in the British royal family, you know, except for the woman.
I'm assuming you must be pretty sure of your claims to be saying this on kind of radio and in the public and all that kind of stuff, because I guess we can be pretty sure that your views are not popular.
Well, they're actually incredibly popular, and Queen Elizabeth has acknowledged me several times, and so has Prince Philip, and so have a lot of the other members of the royal family. But
how did that acknowledgement show itself?
Well, I'll get to that, but it's just fascinating in itself, the illegitimacy of the British royal family. But, you know, once you get to see who's illegitimate and how often they've been illegitimate, you realise that they've been running a program of illegitimacy in the British royal family on a permanent basis, and on a to-be-noticed basis, for a certain program to end at a certain time for a certain outcome, and I'm part of that certain outcome.
Okay, we've got 20 minutes, mate. We need to find out what that is.
So, Prince Philip was actually swished, right? So he was born Prince Philip, but he was swished by the OSS, which became the CIA. So Prince Philip is actually a CIA, I always say CIA, mafia, swish baby. Right?
Swish.
So swish.
So not like a changeling. What does swish mean?
Well, it's like switched, but it's called swish baby.
Okay.
Right.
So it is like a changeling.
Like Bill Clinton's also a swish baby.
So he's not Bill Clinton then? Or?
No, he's William Churchill Clinton.
Okay.
The mother's Pamela Harriman. Pamela Harriman and Bill Clinton look identical. Bill Clinton and Queen Elizabeth II are half-brothers. Half-brother and sister. Because Winston Churchill sired Queen Elizabeth, and Winston Churchill's daughter-in-law was Pamela Harriman. They kicked the husband's son out, and Winston Churchill sired a child with Pamela Harriman, and that child was born on Max Aitken's estate in England, and then flown out to America to be raised by anaesthetists, you know, people that erase your memory. Yeah. And if you look at Pamela Harriman and if you look at Bill Clinton, they are identical, absolutely identical. And no one really knows what Winston Churchill looked like because he's so fat. Yeah. And just a short digression, when Pamela Harriman died, Bill Clinton had made her ambassador to France, and he sent Air Force One out to pick up the body. And at the funeral, Bill Clinton said these words: "I am here in no small measure because she was there." End quote. Yeah? I am here in no small measure because she was there. Yeah, that was him acknowledging that Pamela Harriman was his mother. So Bill Clinton and Queen Elizabeth were half-brother and sister, and that's why during Bill Clinton's impeachment, it was Queen Elizabeth that got him off. Right?
Yeah.
So then we have to look at the other children. So Prince Philip is not a prince. He's a CIA mafia swish baby, and he's big into heroin trafficking. And he's bringing heroin into England and the British Commonwealth in order to destroy it on behalf of the Germans, which is called the DVD, Deutsche Verdekunstdienst. And their motto is, "For us, the war never ended." Right? So Prince Philip has been attacking Great Britain since their secret engagement, and then engagement, and then marriage. So Prince Philip sired Prince Charles. Prince Philip sired Princess Anne, and then the heroin trafficking triumvirate was made up of Prince Philip, Lord Louis Mountbatten, Lord Porchester, and Lord Plunkett. And Queen Elizabeth II is essentially a heroin trafficking mole, and it was her role to have sex with the other heroin traffickers, and she fell in love with him. She fell in love with Lord Porchester and had a child to Lord Porchester called Prince Andrew. And then the other heroin trafficker, Lord Plunkett, Queen Elizabeth fell in love with him. They had a long affair, and they had a child together called Prince Edward. Right, and then Prince Charles had an arranged marriage with Princess Diana, or Lady Diana. And Lady Diana is illegitimate. She is the daughter of Sir Jimmy Goldsmith, who was a Rothschild, and her mother, Frances Burke Roach. And you can tell that, you can get that confirmation, because Sir Jimmy Goldsmith's son, Zach Goldsmith, looks exactly, absolutely identical to Lady Diana. Absolutely identical. So, to continue the illegitimacy of the British monarchy, Lady Diana refused to have sex with Prince Charles, right? And she went to Spain and had four affairs with King Juan Carlos of Spain. And the first affair resulted in Prince William. And if you look at photos of Prince William and King Juan Carlos, both when they're around 26, 28, 30, they are identical. They have the same jawline, the same ears, the same area around the top lip to the nose, which is the area you look at for signatures. But most importantly, Prince William and King Juan Carlos of Spain's ears are identical, whereas Prince Charles' ears are not identical, and Prince Charles has no hairs.
Yeah, indeed. So it sounds like the Rothschilds have been using our apparent royal family as kind of brood mares. Where is this taking us all, do you think? Does it actually...
Yeah. Well, just to finish off there, you've got James Hewitt. Lady Diana had an affair, or Princess Diana had an affair with James Hewitt and produced Prince Harry. So Prince William and Prince Harry are illegitimate. So there are no heirs to the British throne, right? And then both of Prince William and Commoner Kate Middleton. Commoner Kate Middleton's a former Eyes Wide Shut sex worker. She's incapable of having children. She's never been pregnant. All she does is wear a pregnancy belly, and she shows absolutely no signs of pregnancy other than the pregnancy belly. She has no swollen breasts, no swollen ankles, no swollen face, nothing. So the children that appeared of Prince William and Kate Middleton were actually engineered and conceived and gestated in the north of Norfolk, which is actually pretty much where we are now.
We are, yeah, that's exactly where we are. We've got Just Jimmy again has put in, I was under the impression that Diana was from the line of Mary, Queen of Scots. And Donna Chad's put in, she was Spencer, also Churchill, I think. What, do you have anything to say about that?
No, because most of the lines you've got are fake, like Churchill being descended from the Duke of Marlborough is fake. But what we do have, if we go from King George I, he was German, and we go to Queen Victoria, she was German and French and German, and we go to George V, he was Russian and Danish, not English, Russian and Danish. And then we go to Prince William, he's Spanish, right? He's Spanish and English. So we've got, and we go to Queen Elizabeth II, she is American, right? Because Winston Churchill was half American.
So why is somebody working so hard to make a completely illegitimate line? What is the actual function of this thing?
Well, it's interesting because it's actually called a shin or forbidden secret, and it's lasted 200 years and it ended in 2012. And it was started by Mayor Amschel Rothschild, who formed the Rothschilds. He had Mayor Amschel Rothschild and Schon and Sons, which is a banking outfit and bank, and that's Mars, M-A-R-S. And it's questionable if the planet was named, you know, in some relation to that. And the 200-year shin was to end on the 19th of September 2012 or thereabouts. And thereafter, the British monarchy was controlled by the fulfillment of prophecies in the Bible and in the tradition received, right? And the tradition received says that the person who writes the story will come from Lemuria, which is New Zealand, Australia, Fiji. And the Bible says that you will get a wise king from the brother of your nations. So the brother of Great Britain, brother nations, is Australia, New Zealand, Canada, right? And if you overlay Australia, New Zealand, Canada with from Lemuria, Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, you're left with Australia and New Zealand, right? But Australia was actually colonized by convicts, so that leaves New Zealand, right? So they're actually looking for someone from New Zealand to write up the story, right, about the illegitimacy of the British royal family. And
where is your Antipodean accent from?
New Zealand.
Well, wrap me in cling film and call me Doreen. So have you written any books?
Yeah. So I've just completed five volumes called The Hidden King of England, Armour Christie Unveiling the Rose. And it's 1,200 pages and it's got 700 photos, 90% of them never seen before, and a lot of them are of royal marks. And the most important royal mark is a royal mark that Queen Victoria and King John II of England got to me. And it's a letter from Queen Victoria to her firstborn son, Prince Marcos Manuel, when he was 16, in 1850, and it says, assemble him claimant, meaning assemble him claimant to the throne and crown of Great Britain and all Ireland. And I own that letter.
So you actually sound like you've had a fair amount of cooperation from these people, is that right?
it's cooperation under the guise and actuality of extreme tests, extreme hardship, absolutely impossible scenarios, given very little information. In one case, I was given basically one line, and from that I had to write a book. Another, I was given about a page and a half, and from that I had to write a book.
So are you happy with the result that you've turned out? Do you think you're reaching the end of your mission? Is the message that you're after getting across actually now complete, or have you still got more work to do?
Well, it's complete, and you know the British Royal Family is totally aware of who I am. But it's the matter of trying to get it, my position as Prince Pretender and my legal papers recognised by the public and by the judiciary. So in April this year, about the 10th of April this year, I submitted, it was actually recorded, registered by the court on the 14th of April this year, 2015, the claim to the status of Prince Pretender backdated to 3 p.m. on the 1st of March, 2015.
So is this after the last real king died in Spain, as you were saying?
No. It was in Portugal, but there was, let's say politely, a kerfuffle, and I ended up with, and I let the chips fall where they may, I ended up owning the letter from Queen Victoria to King John II saying, assemble and claimant. And I have three titles, which include the title Arch-Treasurer. And Arch-Treasurer stands in for the king when the king's not in the country. And I had been the acting Prince Pretender from the 7th of April to the 7th of August 2012. And I have been the Prince Pretender from the 1st of March 2015.
So what are you going to do when you're king?
Well, since nothing's been done for 160 years, everything.
Well, that's fair enough. Well, I think we've managed to scoot our way through another 3 hours. We're approaching the witching hour. The bars are still open. So I'd like to thank you very much, Greg, for coming on. And again, like everybody else, I'll be listening to and recording your whole talk. And I don't know whether I'll be able to whack my way through 1,200 pages of text. But one way or another, I'll try and find out a bit more about what you're saying. And perhaps you consider coming on again by Skype. We'll have to do it in secret, or so I'll switch the Skype off again. But thanks very much, Greg. It's been great having you on board.
Okay. I'll look forward to talking again.
Very good, folks. So that was Greg Hallett. Speaking with a great deal of confidence, I thought, about matters that are... Hang on, I'm just going to try and manipulate my keyboard at the same time as holding the mic. Give me one second. Talking with a great deal of confidence about the things that can't really be very popular in the corridors of power, and all I can say is that day after day after day we just keep having the rug pulled out from under our feet to reveal another rug which will simply be pulled out from under our feet tomorrow. And I was pretty interested by what Greg had to say. Of course, it seems to me that the whole thing hasn't got any legitimacy anyway, but to discover that it doesn't even have the legitimacy that it appears to have should by now, I suppose, come as absolutely no surprise. So I'm going to be playing out very shortly with a couple of tunes before scooting off to the bar. But we've got, on Friday, we've got Pippa King at 12 o'clock, followed by Nick Collerstrom talking about what they talked about. We've then got Neil Taylor talking about surviving psychopathic social engineering. And then Greg Sammons, who's been on the Dr. Rock Show, talking about The Sun. And his talk is Meet Your Local Star and See the Light. On Saturday at midday, we've got Jonathan Adams, the You Are Being Lied To, the Metaphysics of Propaganda talk, the man that runs Pentos TV. There'll then be a break in proceedings while some witless old git waffles on about sacred geometry and the shape of the sub-ether. He's called Dr. Rock, no idea who Ali is. Followed by Greg Hallett talking about the hidden king of England. And then Andy Goff, the secret hive of history. I met him earlier on tonight. His sounds like a really interesting talk. And then on Sunday, the last day, we've got Steve Pank talking about free energy and the power of gravity, followed by Mark Devlin, free will, consciousness, consent and the corporate music industry. That also sounds like it's going to be a very, very interesting talk. Then we've got an old friend of mine, very old friend now, Melanie Cardwell, talking about understanding iridology. That's a talk I think we have talked about a long time ago on the Dr. Rock show, and I'm sure it's been updated since then. Looking forward to seeing Melanie again. And then it all finishes off in the Pentos talk space with Mark Windows, who's also been on the Dr. Rock show, talking about the Big Society Unveiled. So personally, I'm looking forward to a very interesting time in the Pentos talk space. We're only running from 12 till 6 actually in there, so I should be able to go to all the talks and hopefully record them. And in the meantime, of course, we'll be free for the evenings, and there's two stages here, and I should be going out and seeking more stroppy lyrics from youngsters and seeing what makes me dance, trying to gather a few more CDs and things like that, and getting yet more strange and unusual music to play on the show. I hope you've enjoyed the somewhat bizarre variety of tonight's outing. I'm very grateful to the fact that the computer worked, even though the Skype didn't. Thanks really a lot to Pippa and Greg and John and Dr. Nick for all coming on the show and chatting to me and making it a pretty easy thing. Thanks, of course, as ever, to People's Internet Radio for even being there. I think it's still the only place to be on the internet, really, and I still find it amazing that they let me come and prattle on. And I'm very grateful, of course, to all of you for being out there and listening. There's still some 45 of you in the chat box, which is really, really brilliant. You're brilliant, the lot of you. So next week, not sure what will be happening. We might be hearing one or two of the talks from here. There's a lot of guests lining up nowadays. It's no longer hand-to-mouth, I'm glad to say. Should make my life a little bit easier. But in preparation for going to the bar, because the John Preston Tribute Band are going to be playing here on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and I gather they've now got backing singers that have been trained by their magnificent, orchestrally trained keyboard player. Be interesting to see them, see if they've got a new guitarist, because of course last time I saw them, their guitarist had disappeared to work for some band called Dr. Feelgood or something. So we got the lounge version of the John Preston Tribute Band. Hopefully now they've got a guitarist. So I'm going to play Give Me Everything I Want by the John Preston Tribute Band, and then we'll play out with Motorhead. Apparently Captain Stingray told me it was Lemmy's 70th birthday last week. They released a new single, and let's face it, if Lemmy's made it to 70, then there's hope for all of us.